It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, I can't think of another Iowan I'd be more pleased to hear from at this time, especially during this world COVID crisis, than my guest today. Jim Leach is best known for his 30 years in Congress representing Iowa. That was from 1977 to 2007. And during several years in Congress, he was chair of the House Financial Services Committee. After leaving Congress in 2007, he taught at Princeton, also at Harvard, and served as chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities. That was from 2009 to 2013. He's currently on the faculty at the University of Iowa as a visiting professor and scholar at the College of Law, and I believe in the Department of Political Science, in the College of Liberal Arts. Jim Leach, welcome back to our program.
Well, Ben, I'm pleased to be with you.
I want to reach out to our listeners this hour if you have a question for Congressman Leach. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. First of all, I hope, Congressman, that you and your wife, your family are healthy and coping with social distancing all right.
Well, we are precisely in the sheltering arena. We're in a neighborhood where virtually everyone is, and the only visitors we really have are my son and daughter and the new head of our household, who's my granddaughter, Claire, who's 3 years old. Anyway, in terms of getting out, I do slightly. I do two long walks a day, mile and a half walks, and it amazingly to me, I will only pass one or two or maybe three people in these mm-hmm. walks. And usually they are people with dogs out there walking them. And obviously in our arena, we all kind of circle each other at some distance and wave and nod and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But my wife is laid back and working on her doctoral thesis at the art history department. And so she's taking advantage of this circumstance, I think, as constructively as anyone I know. And to boot, somehow she's able to cook some of our meals, and I try to do the dishes, but that's about it.
All under the supervision of that 3 year old, it sounds like.
That's right. Oh yes. When she says she wants something, she gets something. When she says we should do something, we do those things. It's amazing what command presence these granddaughters have in life.
Congressman, as we all know, it's hard to find an aspect of life that this pandemic has not changed. And I wanted to begin by asking you, what aspects of this global health and economic crisis do you find yourself thinking about most?
Well, there are a whole series of dimensions. One are what are the things that we tap history about and do related thinking. And another is what is going to be novel in all of this. As some friends of mine know, I'm teaching a course in what's precedented and unprecedented in contemporary politics. We've had diseases before. In Iowa was very much involved in one way, in a unique way, in the 1918 ill-named Spanish flu, mm-hmm. Where in Des Moines, we...
Congressman? A congressman, it seemed to have lost Congressman Leach. Congressman, are you there? Or is it... Hello, Congressman Leach. We're trying to reconnect with Congressman Leach. That shouldn't take but a moment. Sorry about that. If you'd like to join our conversation, hopefully without any technical difficulties, as we continue our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps now it's best to email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Let me take a moment to tell you a little bit about what's coming up tomorrow on the program while we try to reestablish Jim Leach on the phone. Tomorrow, some child care providers are closed due to the COVID crisis, and those who are still open may be seeing decreased attendance and income. So tomorrow we're going to focus on child care during this crisis. We'll get several perspectives on the problem from owners of child care centers, from Iowa legislators, and from hopefully from you, our listeners. Perhaps you're in the situation where you've in the past depended on child care, and that has been problematic to get that child care during this pandemic. That's tomorrow on the program. We hope to explore child care, the issues that we're facing there. We hope to be reestablished with former Congressman Jim Leach here in just a moment. Currently, he's a visiting professor, senior scholar at the University of Iowa. Congressman Leach, are you there? We're still having difficulties there.
I have a separate phone if you want to call.
Congressman Leach, this is Ben Kiefer. We're hearing you now loud and clear.
Good.
Okay. Sorry about that hiccup there. Let's continue on. You were talking, I think, about history that is recalled by this crisis and the 1918 wrongly named Spanish flu pandemic, which took, what, 20 million lives worldwide?
It was tremendously large in that neighborhood. And in Iowa, we had, because we're a progressive state, we have been designated both in World War One and in World War Two as the best place in the country for African Americans to train as officers and as soldiers. And we had at two of the bases in Des Moines, the Spanish flu that unfortunately took a number of lives and was quite a tragedy. The other epidemic that was a small epidemic, but it was very symbolic, was in 1758 in Princeton, New Jersey, where America's preeminent theologian, a man named Jonathan Edwards, who is considered the profoundest theologian of the 18th century, had just become president of the university. And he was a religious figure, but he was also very interested in science, and he believed in inoculation. And so he ordered the entire campus, all of the students and faculty, to line up to experiment with an inoculation approach. And he, to lead the way, was first. And basically, he had some sort of statistics of the nature that if you take this inoculation, you had a 1% chance of getting the disease. If you didn't take it, you had a 10% chance of dying. And so he opted for the 1% danger. Mm-hmm. And as it worked out, as everyone got inoculated, he was the 1%.
Oh, my.
And he died a week later.
Oh, my.
But that was an early smallpox approach. A generation later, it got more sophisticated. And then as we moved deeper into this 19th century and the 20th, it got exceptionally sophisticated. The fact that people have been dealing with disease for long periods of time is of great significance. And we've had little bouts around the world for a long time, but they appear to be intensifying, partly because of the globalization that's occurring, partly because of all of the ways of dealing with nature that are man interference in ways that may be augmenting the existence of disease rather than the restraint of it. But we are now in a race for a cure, and yeah, also in a race for dealing with the disease once it's contracted. And in that area, we may have a little bit of good news. There's some thought that on the treatment area that an older treatment for Ebola and other diseases might have some effect of helping treat people that get the disease. But that's very, very unclear at the moment and may not be as hopeful as some people think it might be. Right. As far as this race is concerned, we're in an international competitive circumstance. I mean, we're fighting like mad to deal with the diseases in our own countries, and then the countries are looking for becoming international powerhouses in biochemistry and in healthcare. And so the Chinese want to be first, the Brits want to be first, the Germans want to be first, we want to be first. Mm-hmm. And there are billions of dollars being expended, which makes some people convinced that they're going to have new techniques available within, let's say, 6 months, other people in a couple of years. We don't know, but we all hope for the earlier vaccine than the later. But I think that given the enormous, enormous expenses that are being provided, that some of the time period of traditional disease controls can be beaten a bit. Whether they can be beaten dramatically, only time will tell. Yeah. But it's going to be an issue for all of us of all time. In fact, one of the aspects of this disease could be that it will prepare us for further pandemics in better ways than we were. Right. In fact, interestingly, I had hardly noticed it at the time, but in 2004 or so, George W. Bush, as president, had signed a National Security Council directive saying that we should prepare for pandemics, and that was a very wise directive. Unfortunately, we didn't proceed to do very much in preparation. The fact that the most sophisticated country in the world wasn't prepared is being noted by people around the world. Yeah. I had a personal involvement in a way in this set of issues when I was quite young. I was a young Foreign Service officer, a budding Sovietologist, and was assigned at one point in the part of the State Department's jurisdiction of something called the Arms Control and Agency. And I was a delegate to the Geneva talks on disarmament when we put forth a treaty on the biological and toxin weapons. And I will never forget my first week in dealing with this. I wanted to bone up on biology, which is a subject I'd never dealt with in an academic setting. And so I met with the top biologist at the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. And I made this kind of casual comment as we were walking down the hall. And I said, I can't visualize anything more awful than the equal terribleness of chemical and biological agents. And he stopped me right then and he says, Jim, you are wrong. And I said, what do you mean? How could I be wrong? And he said, just remember, chemical weapons dissipate. And if a chemical weapon finds you in a closeted room, you're in deep difficulty. But if you open the windows, it goes away. Whereas a biological agent is a living organism and can multiply. And what had happened in 1968, President Nixon had gotten interested in the subject of biological weapons, and he'd ordered the State Department to have a national study done by top people in the field. And they came in with a report saying it was too dangerous even for sophisticated countries to try to develop biological weapons because it would be too easy for them to escape a test tube. Mm. And so we negotiated a treaty in Geneva, and we led the way. And we successfully, in this 25-nation setting, got approval, which was then approved by the United Nations and approved by 180 or so countries in the world, a treaty called the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention of 1972. And from that, I have followed kind of from an arms control way the issues of pandemics and whether they could become a international strategic circumstance unrelated to simple health care. And what this pandemic is doing is raising all this attention on this issue. And hopefully you'd say any potential adversary should know it might be as dangerous for them to employ an agent as it is to defend against an agent. And you just hope that people reach a decision not to touch these awful techniques that could exist. Right, anyway, that's a little different perspective than is normal.
Right. But I was interested also in what you said a moment ago, in that this virus could be, and our societal changes necessary, the social distancing and everything, and learning how to deal with very dangerous biological agents, viruses in this case, maybe preparing us for something even worse in the future, that we could think that this particular coronavirus, in hindsight, was a good preparation.
Well, it's a good preparation for a natural breakout, for sure. And I'm confident that we're going to find now huge stockpiling of masks and huge stockpiling of the types of healthcare instruments that people are pointing to. We have to be prepared for the next go around, and hopefully one won't come. Right. Certainly the possibility of new viruses is real.
If you've just joined us, my guest this hour is former Congressman Jim Leach. He served Iowa in Washington for 30 years, currently on the faculty of the University of Iowa as a visiting professor and scholar. Let's talk a little bit, your thoughts on the economic side of this. The Great Depression shaped generations of Americans that followed. What are your thoughts on how this crisis may shape generations to come, is shaping the generations to come?
Well, it's very significant. We have 30 million people unemployed in very rapid fashion. The Depression is one model. A second is the economic recession of 2008. And the most important part of it is how governments respond. And in the Great Depression, basically speaking, the Federal Reserve did not do a very good job. The fiscal side, that is the Congress and presidential agreements, did do some wise things. In fact, Iowans played major roles, like Henry Wallace and others. And so you had the WPA, the Works Progress Administration. You had the CCC, which was basically the biggest environmental work project in history. In fact, when one thinks of the CCC model, where many Americans worked in the national parks, etc., we have a model in the Kiefer family. You have a son that's now a budding firefighter for the Department of the National Park System. Is that right, Ben?
That's right. In the U.S. Forest Service, he's training right now in the in Montana as a wildland firefighter. Thank you for mentioning that. Yes, I didn't even realize that connection. But go on. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting about it is that we have now, I mean, I'm teaching by Zoom at the moment, and you get the feeling that students don't exactly know what's going to happen for their ongoing education. And a couple of former students of mine have talked about having a gap year and talking about maybe putting off going to graduate school or whatever. And it struck me when I learned about your son that model is very intriguing. The idea that people might work for the National Park Service. And oddly, there isn't one environmental issue that is so bizarre that it seems unreal. And I want to tap a speech I listened to in Cedar Rapids a couple months ago. The former governor of Iowa, Tom Vilsack, gave a talk about poop. And you might say, what do you mean, a talk about poop? It just sounded like the weirdest subject in the world for a cabinet member of the United States, a former cabinet member, to be discussing. But it ends up that cows put stuff into the air that is part of the reason for global warming. And so Tom is on a true crusade to try to figure out ways for farmers to capture poop, and in so doing, come up with usages of poop in such a way, A, that they reduce the damage to the environment, and B, produce a new source of income for the farm economy. Now, I'm not sure that we want to have an environmental worker would be inspired by working with poop, but it's one of those bizarre circumstances that Iowa has one third of the country's pigs.
Yep.
We don't have Tom is particularly concerned about cows because he's heading a
We've got just a few seconds before a break. Just a few seconds. Go ahead. We have a few seconds before a break, but go ahead, Congressman.
Okay. Anyway, cows are particularly big producers of this problem. Okay. Please go ahead with your break.
Okay. Please stay on the line. Former Congressman Jim Leach with us for the hour. We're so grateful to have him. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Reflections on the COVID crisis, historical reflections. We'll see where this takes us. We certainly didn't think we'd have the congressman talking about poop there, but we did, and it ties in. Jim Leach back with us after a few moments. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Jim Leach, my guest this hour. Jim Leach served Iowa in the U.S. House for 15 terms, starting in the 1970s. He left Congress in 2007, also served as chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Welcoming your calls for the remainder of the hour, 1-866-780-9100. Congressman Leach, let's go to a caller. Diane is calling from Iowa City. Welcome to the program, Diane. I hope you're well and you're hearing us fine.
Thank you, and I am. I actually served on the Iowa Humanities Board in the early 80s, and so I wanted to pick up on Congressman Leach's tenure when he was the head of NEH. He made a very important commitment to all 50 states of really cultivating and rekindling our commitment to civility in this country. And so last week when I saw so-called protesters, that's the way I want to frame it, in the Michigan Capitol showing up armed to the teeth, how does that help us get through this period where we need to be working for each other and not at each other? And I wondered if he wanted to comment on how all that work that he invested in our trying to recapture the sense of a collectiveness, because obviously there have been wonderful people who have volunteered and other things, but then we need to make sure we have our national leadership focusing on what we need to do to be for each other so that we come through this collectively and maybe even possibly stronger. And I wondered if he would comment on that.
Diane, thank you very much for your question. Congressman Leach.
Well, Diane has a lot of thought in that question. And let me just begin by saying, of all the visages that I've seen in television in the last 6 months, the idea of people with machine guns standing in the Michigan State Capitol is awful. And it also implies something about gun control laws. Apparently it was legal for them to stand there, but preposterous for that kind of protest to take place. And the country has really bifurcated in ways that we have before bifurcated, but usually with reason. For example, in the 1850s, this country was totally bifurcated. By the same token, the issue of slavery. It was a big issue. Today, I've never known a country to become more divided for less reason. There is no reason whatsoever that we should have this terrible, terrible divide. When I teach this course in which precedented and unprecedented, I begin with a discussion of what I consider to be the most relevant speech in American history for today's era. And that speech is the first speech a public official ever gave under the Constitution. And it was given by George Washington at his inaugural. And Washington made a case, and it was unbelievably profound and unbelievably passed out. People talk about his final address, his farewell address, but they don't talk about his first address. And what happened was that Washington had invited James Madison to visit Mount Vernon. He told James about he had to give a speech, and a native had provided him a draft copy, and would Madison critique it? Madison goes in the other room, comes back, and says to the president-elect, he said, "Mr. Washington, this is a terrible speech." And Washington said, "Why?" And Madison said, "Well, first, it's over an hour, and no one wants to tolerate that. And secondly, it's regal, and we're forming a new country with new values." Mm-hmm. And so Washington says to Madison, "Would you like to give me a draft speech?" And he said, "Sure." And a couple of days later, he comes with a draft speech. So this is a speech partly written by James Madison, but the first paragraph could only have been written by Washington, because Washington begins by saying, in a way no governor has ever said, no president has ever said. He began telling this Congress assembled in New York at Federal Hall, and he said to the Congress, "You must realize I wasn't born with many particular abilities." And he said, "I'm not in good health." And he said, "I have no civil administrative experience." In other words, the general who defeated the greatest army at that time in Europe was saying he wasn't very smart, he wasn't very experienced, he was in poor health. I mean, that is bizarre. But in a way, he's reflecting what all presidents are dealing with now. No, you visualize the person you think would be the perfect president, and that person is experienced with only a small smattering of issues that come before government. So all presidents are inexperienced to come. But then Washington goes into how people should make decisions. And he lists these three reasons. He calls them the three no's. That there should be no local prejudices. And by that, he means a national government comes before the state, comes before the special interest in an area. And he said there should be no separate views, meaning that the country shouldn't divide, because people didn't know if it could hang together. And then his third was that there should be no party animosities. You know, Washington hated political parties to begin with. Yeah. But he said the parties have to work together. Well, they're not today. And instead, he gives a reason why people should make the decisions they should make. And he says they should follow pure and immutable principles of private morality. And that sounds absolutely abstract and meaningless, but it's not. It's very meaningful. What he's saying is people should follow their independent judgment based upon decent values. And today we have a Congress that is divided. I call it the caucusization of Congress. The parties meet in caucuses once a week. Yep. And these caucuses are just like football teams at halftime. I mean, how you defeat the other side. Isn't the other side awful? Well, the other side isn't awful. I mean, Democrats are wonderful. Republicans are wonderful. Why can't they get along? It's just bizarre. Anyway, we have great challenges, and there's no reason we can't handle them, because if you look at American society, we have never had greater leadership in almost every part of working life, from business to the arts to the academy. And the only great exception is politics. Right. And that exception is particularly severe at the highest level. I mean, and so all the country has to do is come together and say, we need people to be like our neighbors. We need people that are able and can work together. And if we don't have that, we're going to throw everybody out. And that could happen. We could have new parties. We could have new divisions. I don't know. But keeping with old parties, there's no reason that we can't start thinking again together.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No. But there are some really quite decent people in Washington. There are also some people that are imperfect, but most of all, they're being wrapped up in something that's been with us always, but never agree that it exists today, and that is this money issue is really significant. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem comes from our most respected institution, and that's the Supreme Court of the United States. But even the best and the brightest make mistakes. And the greatest mistake the Supreme Court ever made was in 1857 with what's called the Dred Scott decision, when it said people of color could be bought and sold. That will never be matched in its awfulness. But in the political process, a 2010 ruling, which is called Citizens United, saying that corporations can put undisciplined monies into the political process is absolutely awful. Right. And today you have people in political life playing the money game more than they're playing the issue game. And that's got to change. And we may need a new amendment to the Constitution.
Right. And that's been proposed as the 28th Amendment. I want to remind our listeners, former Congressman Jim Leach is with us for another 10 minutes or so, talking about the current crisis we're facing, and also putting it in some historical perspective, also reflecting on our current politics. How does what you just mentioned, Congressman Leach, tie into what is another sort of threat from within, I'll just call it that, in recent years, the anti-science, anti-intellectual positions that have become popular, positions against evolution, against human-induced climate change, against vaccines, against stem cell research, even attacks against the validity of science itself? How does this tie into where we are, how we got where we are now?
Well, it ties in directly. Now, all societies at all times have some aspects of anti-intellectualism, but we're seeing it to a degree that is truly irrational. And if you take this epidemic, for example, a typical human being like myself is not the least bit an expert on the science of this disease. But most of us should know enough to say, let's rely on science. Let's make our decisions based on science data, not based upon some sort of a personal view. There is a Facebook mantra that is, and I forget just how it goes, but it's in effect saying, our grandfathers went to war to protect our freedoms. And when I think of grandfathers, I think of my own father, who took a 1,600-mile trek from Normandy to the Battle of the Bulge to the Elbe, leading a regiment that was one of the fourth most casualty inflicted of the war, and how proud I am of him. And we're being asked, of all the great sacrifices, to sit on our couch. That's nothing. We can do it. And there's no reason that we cannot be disciplined in this, and that we can't be protective of our neighbors and of our own families. And so there is reason to respect people of different views. And after all, when you have people out of work, when you have people scared to death that they may not have their job back when this is over, you can see why there's frustration. But an invisible enemy, a pandemic, is something we've got to work together on. Mm-hmm. And you'd think it should bring us together as a society, not cause greater disruption. And I just find it moving every night to hear these statistics, and then to hear these wonderful stories of a nurse doing something, of a doctor doing something. I mean, and you want to cry for the wonderful things that are happening in this awful disease circumstance. And then you see the image of people with machine guns in a state capitol building. It's just preposterous.
Right.
And
what do you, we have, oh, about 7 or 8 minutes left, Congressman. Congressman Jim Leach, if you've just joined us on Iowa Public Radio with us live this hour, I would like to see where you turn to for hope. Perhaps, you know, the three-year-old you have, you say, ruling your household currently, brings such a smile to my face when I think of that image. And how a three-year-old or a four- or five-year-old can be, but it's all about the future, and we're all fearful of the future. What do you do in the face of that fear? How do you speak to younger generations about what's to come and what we should be doing? What is your call to action?
Well, what I have tried to do in my course is that everybody's heard the statement, you learn from your mistakes. True. A smarter person also learns from the mistakes other people make. Also true. And a sage learns from what society has done well in the past, as well as mistakes that have been made. And all one has to do is develop a perspective. This town has more extraordinary leaders in more fields than any town in Iowa, and compared to almost any part of the country. Now, that's because we're a fine university community. It's amazing how important people have been in this city for the country. And so I try to tell people, you got to learn what's great. We have the greatest woman rights leadership in American history in this state. We have Carrie Chapman Catt, who led the suffrage movement, and then the day the suffrage amendment passed, formed the League of Women Voters. We had Annie Wittenmeyer, who led a movement to end drink. By the same token, she helped with the suffrage amendment. But these are we have just great people in our history. We've had great environmentalists. I mean, after all, Aldo Leopold, who's the founder of the environmental ethics movement, is from Burlington. We had Ding Darling from Des Moines, who was a essayist and cartoonist with the Des Moines Register, a Pulitzer Prize winner, mm-hmm. who led the environmental movement. We had a congressman named Lacey from Oskaloosa, who wrote the first bills on the environment at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. And we've had great senators, Tom Harkins, the leader in the history of the United States Congress on helping people that are handicapped. You have Chuck Grassley, who's the most important Republican senator in our history. One can agree or disagree on any issue they want with Chuck. But there's no one that's more honest in Washington than Chuck Grassley. I mean, we've had great governors. By the way, on the Republican side, Bob Rae was one of the great moderate governors. He had a model earlier in the 20th century of a man named I'm going blank on the name, but he was Niall Kinnock's grandfather was a two-term governor of Iowa from 1912 to 16. He was one of the finest governors in our history. I mean, we've had great governors. And by the way, the politics is shifting. Now governors are more important.
Right. Let's talk. We have just about 2 or 3 minutes left. And on behalf of some of the callers trying to get on the air, let me ask you a question that sort of addresses what they want to talk about. Our listeners, many of them, Congressman Leach, are wondering what you think of the upcoming general election. We're approximately 6 months before this general election. Your thoughts?
Well, first I want to tell you that in 2016, I did not vote for Republican or Democrat. I voted for Mary Sue Coleman as president and John Papajohn for vice president. I wrote them in. I was not proud of either party's ticket. At this time, it's anybody's guess how this is going to work out and how to presume an outcome would be awkward. I assume that Joe Biden's the candidate. I assume that Donald Trump is a candidate. But who knows? Changes are radical and fast. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. My only advice is for people to participate. Mm-hmm. Then the question is going to be, what are the parties are going to be like in the future? We don't know. The Republican Party is changing dramatically from, I consider myself a moderate Republican. I consider myself an Eisenhower Republican. But I don't identify with aspects of the Republican Party today. But that's everybody's judgment. And every individual should have different judgments, and that's healthy. But you just don't know what's going to happen. I follow the polls literally every other day. I'm on a national political science polling situation that I'm seeing the results of incredible polling. And it is showing America in some shifts, but clearly no certitude yet. And I don't think there'll be certitude until there's a vote taken.
Right. And we cannot, I mean, just based on what's happened in the last couple of months, we cannot know what's going to be 6 months in the future. You're absolutely right. A quick comment, and we really only have a few seconds, about the Democratic Party and the progressive wing not getting its candidate. Very quickly.
Well, very quickly, the Democratic Party had some very, very bright candidates on a political scale, some of the brightest candidates ever presented. But they weren't winning the hearts of people outside the Democratic base. The one that probably had the greatest appeal outside the Democratic Party quite possibly is Joe Biden. Who knows where we're going? I mean, it's pretty obvious that Joe will have a female candidate with him,
right,
as the lead candidate. And
we have to go. I'm sorry.
Go
ahead.
Fair enough.
Okay, Congressman.
It's quite possible Trump will have a new VP candidate, but that's okay. Peace.
Congressman Leach, we'd love to spend the afternoon with you. We have only had an hour. You've been very generous with your time. Thank you very much. Congressman Jim Leach joining us live for the hour. Sorry we didn't get chance for more callers and questions from you. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us for this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.